picture this. You're in a jewelry store in Englewood, New Jersey, back in 1973. And a robbery's going down. Things are out of control. Shots are fired. And when the dust settles, two people are dead. Tragic, right? But here's the twist. One of those who died was one of the robbers shot by the store owner while defending himself. And that is where our deep dive begins, with the case of State v. Canola.
Yeah, it's a wild case, this one. What makes it so interesting is that it really shakes up how we think about felony murder. See, one of the robbers who got away, his name is Leon Canola, he ends up slapped with two murder charges. One for the store owner, obviously. But get this, the other one was for his partner in crime, Harold Laredo, the one the owner shot.
Whoa, 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 hold on. Two murder charges, that doesn't seem right. Can you really be held responsible for a death that the victim of the robbery caused?
Well, that's the question that's at the heart of it all, isn't it? And it's exactly what the New Jersey Supreme Court had to wrestle with back in 1977. And their decision, let me tell you, it sent shockwaves through the legal world. They had to figure out if the state's felony murder law, you know, the one that says murder includes any killings that happen during a robbery, should apply when the victim kills a robber acting in self-defense.
So what they had to decide was, does the law, like, actually mean to punish someone for a death they didn't directly cause?
You got it. And the case's journey through the court system was anything but simple. At first, the trial court said, yep, let's send both those murder charges to the jury. But when it went up on appeal, the appellate division, they were split right down the middle. They agreed Canola was guilty of murdering the store owner, but they couldn't see eye to eye on whether he should be held responsible for his accomplice biting the dust. So it landed right in the Supreme Court's lap.
I bet that was a tough one for them to decide. What kind of things did they have to consider?
Well, you got to understand, there were two major legal theories about felony murder that were, like, going head to head in this case. The majority of the court decided to side with what's called the agency theory. This theory basically says you're only responsible for what you do and what your partners in crime do, but not for someone outside that circle, even if what they do happens because of the felony.
So using the agency theory in this case would mean Canola isn't responsible for the store owner shooting his accomplice.
Bingo. You hit the nail on the head. But the dissenting judges, they were all about the proximate cause theory. Their view was, if someone kicks the bucket because of something you started by committing a felony, you're on the hook for it. A much broader take on responsibility.
So with that theory, Canola starting the robbery was the real cause of his accomplice's death, even if he wasn't the one holding the gun.
You got it. The dissent argued that if you decide to get involved in a violent felony, like armed robbery, you're basically saying, bring on all the consequences, even the ones that seem kind of indirectly related to what you personally did.
That feels like it could lead to some pretty rough outcomes, especially if some innocent bystander gets caught in the crossfire.
I see what you mean, and that's a valid point. The majority opinion actually addressed that very concern. They argued that saying felony murder includes any death, even if it's just remotely connected to the crime, well, that would be what they called regressive. Basically, it would mean punishing people way more harshly than they deserve, and that goes against the basic principles of fairness. They stress that the level of punishment needs to match up with how morally guilty the person really is. You know, the idea that the punishment should fit the crime.
So they felt that holding someone responsible for a death they didn't directly cause just wouldn't be fair.
That's right. They even had this really powerful line in their opinion. It went, gradations of liability must match moral culpability.
Huh.
But hold on, there's another piece to this puzzle, a sort of middle ground, you could say. One of the judges, even though he agreed with the majority's call to toss out the second murder charge, he threw out this idea, what if manslaughter was a better fit in this kind of situation?
Okay, now I'm really starting to see how complex this is. So this judge saw a difference between being innocent of murder but still bearing some responsibility for what happened.
You got it. He was saying there's a difference between being legally in the clear and being morally responsible, and he felt the law should reflect that.
Yeah, that whole manslaughter angle is pretty thought-provoking. It's like he was trying to find some middle ground, right? Not saying the robber was totally innocent, but not holding him fully accountable for a death he didn't directly cause.
Yeah, he was wrestling with those tough questions for sure. You know, where do you draw the line? But going back to the agency theory for a sec, remember, it really zeroes in on what the criminals themselves did. And that actually brings up an interesting what-if scenario. What if, during that same robbery, one of Canola's buddies had accidentally shot Laredo?
You know, I hadn't even thought about that. We've been so focused on the store owner's role in all this. Legally speaking, would that have changed things?
Oh, big time, yeah. Under the agency theory, if one of the robbers had accidentally taken out their own accomplice, chances are Canola would have been found guilty of felony murder, even though it was an accident.
Wait, really? That doesn't seem to make sense. Why would an accidental death within the group of robbers be treated differently than the accidental death caused by the store owner?
It all boils down to where the focus lies. And with the agency theory, it's on the actions those criminals took to pull off the crime. So if one of them accidentally shoots their partner, that death is still a direct result of something they did during the robbery.
So even though both situations involve an accidental death, who pulled the trigger makes all the difference, legally speaking.
You got it. It might seem like a subtle distinction, but yeah, it's a big deal in this case. The court in State v. Canola, they were crystal clear. When it comes to felony murder, it all comes down to the actions of the felons themselves, not the reactions of other people, even if those reactions are a foreseeable outcome of the crime.
I get the whole agency theory thing, but doesn't that mean someone could get off easy if they planned a robbery knowing it might get violent? Like, say they bring guns and tell everyone to be ready to shoot if they have to. Shouldn't they be held responsible if things go wrong, even if they didn't personally kill anyone?
That's a really sharp question, and it gets to the heart of why State v. Canola is such a big deal, even all these years later. It makes us grapple with those gray areas, right? Where our sense of what's fair and just might not line up perfectly with what the law actually says.
It's almost like the concurring judge, the one who thought manslaughter might fit better, was struggling with that same tension, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely he was. Remember, he agreed with the majority about how to interpret the felony murder statute, but he was also worried about letting someone completely off the hook for a death that, while not directly their fault, still happened because of their criminal actions. Manslaughter, to him, was a way to find that middle ground, saying, look, the robber didn't mean to kill anyone, but they did create a situation where death was a real possibility.
So he was basically calling on the legal system to really think about the moral aspects of these situations, not just get bogged down in the technical details of who pulled the trigger.
Right on. And what makes his opinion even more interesting is that he didn't just throw that idea out there. He went a step further and said, hey, legislators, we need you guys to step up and make things clearer. He basically said, the law, as it stands, is kind of murky when it comes to cases like this. We need some better guidelines to make sure justice is actually being served.
That's amazing. So have there been any cases where defense attorneys have actually used Canola to get charges dropped or at least reduced in situations like that hypothetical we were talking about?
You bet. State v. Canola, it's like a go-to weapon for defense attorneys in felony murder cases. It's a powerful tool to argue against applying the felony murder rule too broadly. And it's been cited in tons of cases all over the country.
It's wild to think that a case from a robbery in New Jersey back in 73 is still shaping how the legal system works today.
It really shows you the power of legal precedent, doesn't it? And how the law, it's not some dusty old book. It's constantly evolving, changing with every case that comes along. And sometimes one case, like State v. Canola, can make us rethink the whole idea of responsibility, intent, justice, the whole shebang.
So what does all this mean for the lawyers and law students out there trying to wrap their heads around this stuff? What are the big takeaways from State v. Canola that they should remember as they navigate this crazy legal world?
I think the biggest thing to remember is that the law isn't just about memorizing rules and cases. It's about understanding why those laws exist, how to apply them to real-life situations that are always messy and complicated, and accepting that there will always be gray areas where you got to think critically and make nuanced arguments. State v. Canola is a perfect example of how a single case can throw those gray areas into sharp relief and force us to really think about the law and how it plays out in the real world.
This has been a truly eye-opening deep dive, and I feel like we've just scratched the surface. I bet there are a ton of other cases that build on what State v. Canola started. So what's next for us as we continue to explore this fascinating area of law?
You know, you're right. There's always more to learn. But before we wrap things up, I think it's worth taking a step back and considering the big picture impact of State v. Canola. We've talked about how important it is for defense attorneys, but why should anyone outside the legal world care about this case from 1977 New Jersey even today?
That's the key question, isn't it? State v. Canola didn't just change how lawyers approach these cases. It really got to the heart of some fundamental ideas about fairness and accountability. Remember how the majority opinion really stressed the importance of making sure the punishment fits the crime, morally speaking? That idea, it goes way beyond just felony murder. It gets to the core of how we as a society decide what consequences are just and fair.
So it's almost like it's a philosophy lesson disguised as a legal case.
Yeah, I'd say so. And that's probably part of the reason why it's been cited in over 40 states. Courts all over the country, when they're dealing with tough felony murder questions, they look to canola for guidance. It just goes to show how this case tackled some really universal questions about cause and effect, intent versus outcome stuff that we all think about in our own lives, really.
It makes you wonder what would happen if the New Jersey legislature actually took up that challenge from the concurring judge. You know, the one who thought they should step in and clarify the law. Would they create a whole new category for, like, felony manslaughter or something?
No, that's a great question. It would be totally uncharted territory in New Jersey, but other states have definitely tried different things. Some have come up with clearer definitions of what in furtherance of a felony actually means, so the rule doesn't apply as broadly. And some have introduced less serious offenses, like you said, to address those gray areas where saying it's straight up murder might be too harsh.
So even though the legislature hasn't done anything yet, canola started a conversation that's still going strong. Not just in New Jersey, but all across the country.
Exactly. And that in itself is a good thing for the evolution of the law, even if it takes time. But for folks in the legal world, especially those working on criminal cases, canola offers some really practical guidance, too. It's like a roadmap for how to analyze things like causation, intent, and responsibility when you've got multiple deaths happening during a felony.
That's so important. These aren't just abstract legal theories. They have a huge impact on real people's lives.
You said it. And canola reminds us that even though statutes provide a framework, every case is different. Each one needs to be looked at carefully with attention to the specific details. Defense attorneys especially need to be super thorough when they're looking at the chain of events, you know, figuring out who did what and then making sure that the charges against their client really reflect how responsible they actually are.
This deep dive has been incredibly insightful. I feel like I have a much deeper understanding of State v. Canola now, and also a greater appreciation for how legal arguments work and how they shape the whole justice system.
I'm glad to hear it. If there's just one thing I hope our listeners take away from all of this, it's that State v. Canola, even though it was decided over 45 years ago, it still has so much to teach us. It reminds us that the law isn't some set-in-stone thing. It's a conversation, a process of figuring out how to deal with these complicated human situations. And that process is always evolving.
I think that's a great way to put it. And with that, we'll wrap up this deep dive. We encourage everyone to keep exploring the intricacies of felony murder, causation, and the ongoing quest for justice. See you next time.